Hello and welcome to yet another interview on Rethink Peer-to-Peer Kredite. I'm your host, Danny Neidhardt, and today I'm joined by Mintos CEO, Martins Schulte. Martins, thanks a lot for taking some time, especially in this busy time of the year. Please let us know how you're doing personally.
Thanks, Danny. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been, actually, if you ask personally, it's been a very interesting few months lately, of course, also because of the business-wise, but also myself, I managed to break my ankle. So I've been on the recovery for like 3 months. So now I'm actually getting back to kind of proper walking and all this stuff. So on a personal level, it's also been very interesting, of course. First fraction. So new experience for me.
I'm sorry to hear that. I hope you're on a speedy recovery. Do you just want to quickly tell, if you like, how that happened?
I actually picked up mountain bike riding, so basically MTB, and then in one of the practices, just unlucky fell, and there you go. The shin, the surgery, screws, crutches, and all the stuff which goes with that, but it's fine.
Okay. Sorry to hear that. I hope you recover soon. If you want to see a positive side, maybe, you know, staying home these days is not that unusual. So you can combine probably all the important.
Exactly. I was on a personal lockdown already for quite a while. So it's nothing new for me.
Okay. Martins, 2020, you said it already in the introduction, a lot of things have happened, especially also business-wise with Mintos. Let's dive right into a couple topics that I have prepared for today's interview. I would like to start off with the recently finished crowdfunding campaign. Mintos, exceptional, great result. You raised a bit more than 7 million euro. Just in general, what's your take on this, and maybe also how relieved have you been about the final result? And
I think the crowdfunding has been always what we had in mind. So actually, when we look back, so over the years, we actually have seen many investors reaching out to us and without any reason, just asking like, "Can I buy some shares in Mintos?" So. When we sit down and then now look, hopefully with the crisis kind of subsiding and we look down the road with 2021 and beyond, and basically what we looked at. So it is a good time, especially with the license which we are getting to invest in the growth. And we put together the fundraising plan and then crowdfunding fit very nicely with that. And obviously we are super happy for the results. So we ended up with, according to the data, which is the largest campaign outside of the UK in Europe. So as you say, 7 million, more so what I'm happy about and what well, basically we all are happy is that 7,000 investors joined and there was a lot of interest, definitely much more interest than we expected. Having said that though, I would say we were confident that there will be quite a bit of interest in investing in Mintos equity. So overall, obviously very good result, but as with any sort of fundraising, it's not a goal in itself or, it's a milestone in a way and a validation, especially when it comes from your community. But at the end of the day, it's just a tool for us to execute on the vision or on the roadmap what we have in front of us. So nothing stops there. So sure, we celebrated a bit, but in general, just get back to work and continue executing and on building a great product for our customers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. There's a quick observation that I made in the past days. So I think officially it was communicated that 7.2 million euro have been raised as a peak. Now, I saw in the past couple of days that this amount was lowering always a bit. So I think right now, when you look at Crowdcube as of this day on December 11th, it's like 6.9 million euro and also for less equity. So I think in the peak, it was 9.45. Now it's 9.28. Can you just quickly explain or do you know why that has lowered now in the past days?
Yeah, so basically, what the Crowdcube does, and that is basically a requirement by the FCA, the UK regulator, So they have to give you a cooling off period. And that's basically means that they send out the email. Okay, here's a cooling off period. It's going to run for like a week. Until then, you can still decide that you don't want to participate. So for one or the other reason. So that's one part. And then the other is that some of the investors might not go through the AML checks. So the CrowdCube have to also check your AML. So they have to identify you. Some of investors might not be. So that's very typical. That's actually standard. I guess what CrowdCube says is you might see like even like up to 3 to 5% of total investment amount to reduce in this cooling off period. So that's something which also that's the reason why you see that it went down from 7.2 to 6.9, I guess is today, and yesterday the cooling off period ended, so that will be the final amount basically what we will raise in this round.
Okay, good, thanks for explaining this. I want to have a quick callback to the very first Ask Mintos Anything session that you started in March. Quite popular format then throughout the year. Back then you said like Mintos has runway capital of 3.6 million euro, which would help Mintos to continue with its operations for the next or the upcoming 15 to 18 months. Now, a recent interview that I saw that you had on the channel with Christaps, you said like right now you have around 2 million euro cash in your bank account. To me, the question, how urgent and how immediate was that funding needed for Mintos to continue its operations right now?
It depends how you define kind of continue. So if you would want to continue and basically have a steady state and just remain where we are at, basically having the same, say, number of customers or the same number of loans available and then funded, then basically we would not need the capital. So, but that's not why we are here. So what we'll look for is there's much kind of opportunity ahead of us, especially with the licenses which we get, and that's going to require capital. So, and if you look from that perspective, that we want to invest today so that we can build a better and bigger organization in the future, then the fundraising comes into the play. So from that perspective, fundraising obviously is crucial. From just running the business, well, we are more or less kind of break even today. So many of activities like today of 160 people, which we are, and our main expense are salaries. So many of activities, what we do are not necessarily related to kind of maintaining the current business. For instance, the same, the same IBAN account. While it's not going to change like the current business, but we have to work on implementing that. So, or the same about the mobile app. So you could argue that mobile app is, for instance, is you could run the business without the mobile app easily. So it's not going to change the current business. So from that perspective, it was not very crucial from the perspective that we want to invest in growth and basically put to the good use the license which we are getting. Then both crowdfunding and also now with the crowdfunding finished, so we are back to very active work with venture capital. So both crowdfunding and hopefully also venture capital will help us to actually take the best of this opportunity and basically invest in growth, which is something which companies or startups at this stage where we are at usually would do when they see the opportunity ahead of us.
At the beginning of the crowdfunding campaign, like the target that you set for this was 1 million euro in exchange for 3% of equity. I don't know if it was 3.15 or something, but around 3% of equity. And you gave pretty much a conservative valuation, as Mintos phrased it, with 68 million euro. Why has Mintos offered an initial discount of around 50% for that first million euro?
50% discount in what sense do you mean?
So to be in line with, let's say, a valuation of 68 million euro, yep. Normally the equity offered for 1 million euro that you wanted to raise should have been 1.47, I think. So basically, when you scale up the equity to 100%, you would come up to around 30, 33 million, which would be like half of what you think the valuation of Mintos actually is. So to me, it seems like the first million seems like a 50% discount. Now, when we look at the current numbers that you have, like 9% equity for 7 million euro, that's much more in line with the valuation Mintos has. So has that first million been discounted with a 50% rate, or am I misreading something in this?
It's not. So all the shares are exactly the same price, so there's no discounts or whatnot or anything else. How it works is that the valuation, which you said, is a pre-money valuation. So it's basically before we raise any money. So the 1 million which we would have raised would mean that our post-money valuation would be 68 plus 1, which means 69 million. And then if we raise, so we end up is raising 7 million, then our post-money valuation is actually 75 million, 68 plus 7. So, and that's how you get also the percentages. So basically you have to divide 1 million by 69, or you then divide 7 by 75, and that gives you the same kind of price of the share. So the missing part, I guess, is that the valuation 68 million is pre-money, before we actually go out and raise money. Once we raise the money, obviously the value of the company increases by at least the cash which we have raised. So with 7 million raised, so our post-money valuation is 68 plus 7, which is 75 million euros. So there's no discount. All the shares are exactly the same price, which was set for crowdfunding at 6 euro 12 cents was the share price for any investor. Was it the investor who invested the first or the investor who was the last? It's the same 6.12 euros.
Okay. But maybe there's just something missing from my understanding. But when you offer so you raised more funds but gave up less equity, that's how it seems from the outside. So that's why I was a bit confused how
that actually adds up. No, basically what we do, we give up more equity. So how it works is basically we issue new shares. Since we issue new shares, then basically that's going to take more equity, or in percentage wise, it's going to take up more of the 100%, which is total, of course, of the equity is 100%. So at 1 million, that would be basically, we can do a quick math, at 1 million, you would give up about 1.4% of the company, or basically that million will represent 1.4%. And then at 7 million, that represents about 9.3%. It's basically the value, the raised money has to be divided by the post-money valuation to see how much of the company the raised or the new investors actually hold.
Okay, I see. Thanks again for explaining this. To me, now when we look at the final result of the crowdfunding campaign, like 6.9 million euro for 9.28% equity, my impression is like when you set up the target of 1 million euro, obviously you have, you know, achieved a way better result. But I was thinking, you know, now that you gave up basically three times as much equity for those shares, having also that conservative valuation of 68 million euro in mind, wouldn't it have been maybe more sensible to raise less money? So say maybe, okay, we had a target of 1 million euro, but we're also happy to take 2 or 3 million euro and give up those shares, continue with the operations, understanding that, you know, there's also a venture capital round to follow, which you said would be of a much bigger extent, and just use that short-term capital for your needs, for your business needs, and then continue to grow Mintos. So you give up less equity, basically as of this time being, and then later on, you know, you can offer it basically for a much bigger worth and but much better share price. Can you take something about this?
That is a trade-off, obviously, which you have to make. And that was something which we also, when we saw that there is so much interest, is something which we discussed internally quite a bit. And that is also the reason why we cut short the campaign. So initial campaign was actually, idea was to keep it open for 20 days. So we cut it short in half. So we actually finished at 10 days because at one moment we realized, okay, it doesn't make sense to raise more. And the trade-off is really, I guess, sure, it's, well, you give up more equity in a way, but then of course you get the cash. But more so what we saw also, that there's a lot of invested interest. So there's a lot of people who actually would want to be part of the Mintos journey. And then basically what we saw, okay, we want to give this opportunity. Also from the business perspective, of course, having more investors on board, then that's in a way also kind of a marketing exercise. So you get people who can then maybe spread the word among their friends and acquaintances. So it's not that only you can only look at the cash or the dilution which you get. So it's other things which you also took into consideration, and we basically just wanted to give the opportunity to all people who wanted to participate. So we think that most people who wanted, they got the chance to participate. We don't know if we will ever run again another campaign, so better to give you this opportunity. And sure, with evaluation, always you can think it could be give up less or more, but then also cash is cash, so that also helps us to execute on our vision. And if we now look at the world which we live into now, it's still uncertain world, so we don't know how it's going to go like in 2021. So if it's the pandemic going to subside, it's not going to, so how the vaccination going to go on. So these are all the things which you have to take into account. And then basically we decided, okay, we will stop at 7 million raised. Basically that's what we decided internally, by giving up basically around 9% of the company.
Okay. As I said, you plan obviously to finish up this fundraising round with a much bigger venture capital round, which is about to follow very soon. You said it quite often. How much equity do you want to offer additionally, and also which funding volume do you expect in return then?
Funding volume also, that's something which we have discussed here and there. It's around like 15 million euros is something which we are looking to raise from the venture capital. Obviously, 15, that depends.
1.5,
yeah. It depends, of course, on the interest. It could be more. It could be, if there's less interest, it could be less. Definitely doesn't make sense just to raise like a few million in our stage. So it's either going to be like around 15, or then we just decide, okay, it's not the best time now. But basically, we can go out and raise funding from venture capital when we get the licenses, so that we can take that off the table and that doesn't affect kind of negotiations. And then also that gives a stronger position when it comes to the valuation. And valuation, well, it's going to be negotiation and kind of the discussion which we will have as a part of our process in raising the funding. Obviously, valuation is important, but that's not the only important thing. So there are many other things which you have to look as, like, what is a fund, what their experience, what about the controls, and plenty of other things which you put on the table when you basically think about the fundraising. So that's earmarked for the early next year when we get the licenses, and let's see how it goes. So far, the feedback has been good, but obviously, as is any other fundraising, so you can say that there's interest only when you get the funds in your bank account. So everything up to then is basically just discussions.
Mm. And can you quickly comment also on how much equity ideally you plan to give up or to offer for those 15 million euro in return? Will that strongly correlate to what the crowdfunding campaign was then?
Yeah, well, it's obviously as a company, well, it still will be perhaps a few months or half a year between then and when we raise. So if you get a bigger organization and we get the license, so one would expect that the valuation is higher. So it's definitely would not be lower. So most likely would be higher, but it's very premature now to say like about valuation. So let's see how it goes. Let's see what's how much is like real interest out there. So and then we can discuss. So evaluation is in a way you want to optimize for the valuation, but then on the other side you also want to just get it done, so that you can go back to the business and invest in executing your roadmap. So definitely we'll keep an eye. I know with 7,000 investors on board, of course the less dilution they have, the best. And us as a early co-founders and our angel investors, obviously also we look at the dilution. So it's a rather complex equation which you have to look at when you kind of consider one offer versus the other offer, and it's not only valuation.
Mm. Is there any limit in terms of how much equity you want to give up?
I think it's more limited from the perspective of how much money you want to raise. So we see it for our roadmap to execute on that. So it's perhaps at this stage, something like 20, 25 million is something that, what we would want to raise at this moment. More than that, then that would mean that basically we raise capital, which is then sitting on our balance sheet and is not used. So basically you perhaps are overfunded, which is another kind of consideration where you don't want to go into. So it also doesn't make sense to raise like too much capital.
Okay, understood. And very last question now to finish up this this fundraising discussion. When do you expect to close that second funding round then with a venture capital fund?
We're going to start early next year. So let's see when we get the license. So our current estimate is that we should get them in Q1 next year, maybe Q2. And then it's going to depend on kind of the process with the venture capital funds. So it's hard to give like exact timeline. So usually people say perhaps like 3 months, maybe 4 or 5 till you get to the closing. But in our interest, well, as for any other company or startup, you're just going to want to get it done so that you can get back to work and basically build a company instead of run around in endless meetings and discussions about fundraising.
To which extent is that licensing a necessity before finishing off that negotiations with a venture capital fund? So is that something like to have additional security, an additional increase of the worth of the security, or because you mentioned now a couple of times it will happen only after the licensing process. Is that a necessity from the counterparty in most cases, or why is that?
It just gives you more power in negotiation. So basically, well, you have the one item off the table, so there's no uncertainty if they're going to be licensed or not. So, and especially when you have like one party which is investing like considerable amount of money, so that for them it might be an kind of a prerequisite to invest. There's no kind of prerequisites now, but basically we just see we are so close to getting them that it doesn't make sense now to kind of go out and try to raise before, and then still the question will be like when you're going to get the license.
Okay. Good. Then, let's discuss just very briefly the previous year, or the year that we're still in, 2020. What's your personal recap of 2020 from Mintos' perspective?
I think obviously the 2020 was a challenging year, and in a way, of course, interesting year. Like, of course, all the years have been interesting, but 2020 was something very different than what we saw in the first 4 or 5 years of operation. So it was challenging, the same as it was challenging for many other businesses. I think, we were not in this, say, I don't know, we were not like in a travel business where it's basically like everything is like doomed and like super bad. And we were also not in, I don't know, video conferencing business. So we were somewhere in between. So, and we just had to deal with the cards which we were dealt in 2020. And at the end of the day, as with any crisis, I guess, the saying that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, well, that applies. So the key is just to go through that, kind of manage what you can manage and do your best. And that's also what we try to do in 2020.
To which extent would you say that you're happy that this year is finally over?
To some, obviously, to some extent, I am happy. So obviously, if you look back at 2019, when we, at the end of the year, we were looking at 2020. So we were expecting to double, maybe even triple the business. So now we're going to basically grow at something like 15, maybe 20% this year. So it's day and night, obviously, with respect to our plans. But to the extent that the crisis obviously gives like some learnings for many of us. Like, of course, it's for us as a business. So before 2020, we didn't have such a team as like a recovery team. So, or we didn't have the, because there were no cases where we had to work with recoveries. So We didn't have experience like what it means when the lending company goes out of business and we have to take over the portfolios and how that works and does it really work in real life or not, so, and what we can improve and so forth. So a lot of things which we could improve, and also when we look at the learnings what our customers had, starting with the lending companies as well. So we should realize, okay, I have to have diversified funding sources if I just rely on one in form of Mintos. So that basically can, the liquidity can dry out quickly, as we saw in March. And that then basically actually ended up with quite a bit of problems for some of the lending companies. And finally, but not the least, I think also investors learned that double digit returns like 12, 13, or even 15% doesn't come with zero risk. So there's going to be some loans which end up in recovery and some which are going to end up in bad loans, and that's just part of investing. So there's been a lot ton of learning, I think, for 2020. And then on top of that, I think what is, to the extent I'm kind of happy, well, as much as happy you can be about any crisis, is that finally we got an answer like what happens in a crisis. So before 2020, there were people and investors asking, yeah, well, but it hasn't gone through the crisis, we don't know what's going to happen. So whatever is answered, at least now we can say, okay, this is what happens in a very major crisis, one of the biggest since what people say since the Great Depression. So that's what happens. So at least there's an answer, whatever it is. So that's also, to that extent, I also would be happy and take the best out of the crisis, what we have had, and well, it's still in a way ongoing. So the pandemic is still out there. It's still, the confidence is not there. So it's still going to take some time. But well, most likely we're not going to have those shock moments or shock moment which we had in March. So now, well, you have to go in lockdown. Well, you know, you go in lockdown. So you know what it's going to involve. And with all the vaccines in front of us, so it's also perhaps much easier to then look into the future with at least some confidence.
Mm. What would be like the major learnings out of this crisis? As you said, quite admirably, you know, in every crisis there's also an opportunity. But what were, from your perspective, like maybe a couple of learnings that you can take out from this this past year?
I think it's most likely across like many functions, so it's hard to single out like one or like a few specifically. I think when it comes to our operations, or basically what we can influence, is definitely learnings about like specific countries on the kind of legal side, what we can do and what like works on paper, but in practice it's maybe at least to that setup doesn't work that nicely. So that's something. It's also about the I think about the basically educating investors, I would say, in a way. It's but if you look also now with all the 2020, actually a very well diversified investor, somebody who would have invested across all loans at all times, he or she or it, if it's a business, they would look at only, well, only, but it's also relative, but they would look at perhaps like 8, maybe 10% of potential loss of capital in 2020, which you, if you combine it with like 5 years of like 12% return, so you end up with expected return of 10%. So this diversification is something which we try to educate, but we have to continue and work on that you have to diversify, unless of course you are investor who thinks that you have superior information to the rest. But then it's a good question, do you really have superior information? Can you really kind of predict what's happening in the space? So that's something. And then also with the lending company, so definitely the way how we operate with them is something, many things which we on a short notice improved, and I think now we are in a much better position than we were before March 2020, for sure.
Maybe a question that goes hand in hand with that last statement of yours. Can you say like what have been, from business perspective, your biggest appointments, the disappointments this last year?
Mm, Biggest disappointments. It's hard to kind of single out like specific disappointment. I mean, we are so diversified that those situations and things come in many different forms and fashions. So it's hard to say that you are specifically disappointed by this and that. I think to some extent, I would say disappointment, if I would have to single out one, is, and this is something we should also learn that we have to pay even more attention to, is really kind of double checking and triple checking the people and the management behind the, when we look at the lending companies, like who are they? So basically disappointment could be that, seeing that some people actually don't have the integrity, which we assume they have. So that's perhaps something which you will end up facing in business one way or the other. And in crisis situations, you face it. Well, some people perhaps don't have the integrity which you have or which you would expect like people to have. So that's in a way disappointment. But then, I mean, I'm also not anymore like 20 years old, so I've seen like world a little bit. So that's something which, well, you just have to live with it. And the more business you do, the more chances you have that you can run up into those type of people one way or the other.
Yeah, with my question, maybe I could have provided a bit more context. You know, it could have been in many directions. You could have said a bit disappointment that from Mintr's perspective, you may have overlooked a couple of things in certain processes where you could have performed better. It could be a disappointment that maybe investors have, you know, withdrawn a lot of funds and that you thought with a better education, you could have persevered some of those effects that then were that outplayed then on Mintr's, or it could be on the lending companies. So, but obviously now we understood where like your primary pick would go. So it's more, you know, what concerned you the most in a negative way would have been collaboration structures with then the lending companies that you work with.
And as I said, so you could pick like, it's hard to single out one. So you could pick easily the same. You mentioned so about the same. Investors, in a way, sure, we can feel disappointed, but then it's also something which we have been working and could continue working. Is in a way, I'm of course, I'm not necessarily kind of disappointed, more kind of in a way, well, maybe heartbroken is not the best word, but it's just sad to look that investors have not diversified, and those investors who have the most in the recoveries, those are which we take the profiles and we see, well, they have invested in only in 1, 2, 3 countries in loans originated by few companies. And unfortunately, for one reason or the other, they ended up in recoveries and they have significant amount of the portfolio in recoveries. And it's sad to look at that because you could actually solve it super easy by just diversifying across all the loans. And that is the value which we can bring on the table, that when something happens and if you're diversified, it's going to affect only a small part of your portfolio. And that's something, of course, on the investor side. And then if you look at what we could have done differently, sure, it's with the hindsight, it's super easy to say, well, you could have done this or that, but we also have to realize that what we are providing is not an investment opportunity where there's no risk. It's not possible to have like 12-13% return and have zero risk. So that doesn't happen. So it's gonna it's gonna come in one form or the other, even with the pandemic or without the pandemic. There's gonna be risk. There's gonna be in recoveries. There's gonna be bad default. The thing is like, how big is it? Now with the data what we have, so we see expected default is around like 2-3% a year, which still at these rates gives you what we would consider good risk adjusted. 10% return after bad defaults, mm-hmm. after bad debt. So with the hindsight, of course, it's easy to say, well, you should have done this or that. But well, I think with all the information which we had and at the stage which we were, we did what we could do the best at that time. Mm-hmm.
Now let's shift a bit more because we open up that topic a bit more towards the loan originators, the lending companies that you work with. Now you said already maybe there's a questionable integrity of some management people in those companies that you didn't expect. I don't want to continue this. I would, you know, just pick the interview that you recently had with Christophs, where you elaborated on this already. So when people want to watch this, they can hear, you know, how you go a bit more into detail here. I want to maybe put it back a little bit on Mintos, because maybe the question is also for some, okay, to which extent did Mintos also fall for this? And could Mintos have done anything different to prevent maybe certain circumstances that you're in right now with loan originators? I mean, for a very long time now, Mintos has offered various forms of rating loan originators. You had different scoring models to basically evaluate the quality of those companies. Now, I would like to know, on a scale from 1 to 10, as you currently also have it in place with the lending companies, how would you personally rate the Mintos due diligence quality of assessing loan originator risks properly? Whereas 10 is the best.
Yeah, I think, and that also just as a background, so the risk score is not only about the loan originator. So with a new Mintos risk score, it's actually four different verticals which we look at. First and foremost, we look at the loan performance. And for the loan performance, actually, the performance of the loan originator is, in a way, not relevant, because the loan has been originated. It is performing or it's not performing. So the loan originator only affects it to the extent how good they are with credit scoring, and then to some extent also with servicing. Loan originator comes much more into the play when it comes to loan servicing. So that's obviously the loan originators are servicing, which means they are collecting the payments and so forth. So that's where we rate the lending company. And then, of course, the buyback, for sure. That's also the lending company. Both of those actually servicer, and the buyback could be also any other company. Another third-party company. For servicer, it could be just a debt collection company. For buyback, it could be insurance company. Sure. And that's something which also might actually have in the future, that for some loans, it's actually some other companies doing those things. And then it's cooperation structure, which is more about legal stuff and that side. Overall, I would say that I would give like a good 7 for us, for our ability to properly assign those ratings. We have to take into account that we can do only that good job. It is limited to the job we can do is limited to how much history we have. And some of the things which we do, there's just not enough history for us to have any historic data and any kind of statistical data so that we can say, okay, this is how it should be done. So in those cases, it's still a judgment call from us based on the information which we have, which is, of course, not also us. Investors say that they don't have all the information. Well, we have much more than investors, but also us, of course, we don't have like 100% of the information. Well, nobody has, I think. Also, lending companies, when they issue a loan, of course, they also don't have 100% information how the borrower gonna perform. So given that, I would say my good 7, there's definitely room for improvement, but I think we are approaching when we can be very confident about the ratings which we assign. And those ratings we will see after, after like another business cycle, when we can say, okay, if it was rated at like 8, 9, expected default should be lower than if it was rated at like 4 or 5. And that's basically what the ratings do. So the same, if you look at the Fitch ratings, well, AAA doesn't mean that there's no default. There is default. It's just going to happen like once in a 40 years, not once in a 10 years, for instance.
Where maybe you can become a bit more precise, where do you think Mintos, so if you rate 7 out of 10 as a quality or due diligence quality of Mintos, 7 out of 10, where do you see room to improve? And maybe just a quick comment also before you answer, maybe because you're saying like some sort of an excuse, that's how I interpret it, how I read it right now, is you don't have all the data, but maybe not having all the historic data or not having the track record with a lending company could maybe a sign of, okay, instead of going all in with a loan portfolio, you just take a small fraction and you set up a collaboration step by step and increase the loan portfolio on Mintos over time. So maybe that's, I don't know, something that Mintos is something they can improve also moving forward. But maybe you can say a couple of comments on where do you think Mintos can improve this due diligence process.
When I say more data, I would more kind of referring to, I guess, soft data, meaning, I mean, we don't know like ins and outs of each and every market, like what is the competitive position, how the market going to develop and so forth. So we have like a good understanding, but it's not like complete data, and you're never going to have complete data. When it comes to the portfolio data, vintage analysis, like financials, that we all get, so that we can kind of work on, but also there, the quality of data kind of going to differ. So for some, we're going to have more structured data, for some less, and that also affects how well we can assign the rating. When it comes to the limiting, so that's actually what we already do now. So for the lending companies, we do have limits how much of the portfolio we are happy for them to place on the Mintos. So that's going to be function also of the rating. So that's already in place and has been in place. So there are kind of percentage limits how much of the portfolio they can place. Where we can improve, I think, just overall, just having the in each and every vertical, just with experience, being better at making those judgment calls where we have to. So with the Mintos risk score, what we are going forward or going towards to is that there's little judgment calls. That is much more data driven, and it's basically okay. This is the data we have. This means that is a rating which we should assign. So there's less judgment. But it's still, obviously, I mean, we started the ratings, I think, Mintos rating, the first iteration was like 2 years ago or something. And now it's only the first time when we see how they operate when the crisis hits. So we can see, okay, this is actually what happens with somebody rated that high and somebody rated that high. So with the Mintos risk score, the same. So all the loans, we will have to see with time how good we are actually with assigning the rating and risk score.
Okay. Looking back, would you say Mintos has done any mistakes in this process of loan risk assessment or loan originator risk assessment? Considering also, you know, to which extent do you know things at a certain time, obviously, but you think Mintos has made any clear mistakes in the past in this process?
I think we all the time make mistakes. It's just a question like how big mistakes they are. So. I don't think it's kind of huge mistakes what we've done. If you ask about Mintos rating, I understand.
No, in general, the Mintos loan originator risk assessment. So regardless of any scoring models that or maybe you can consider this as a mistake implementing this, but this would more have an effect than like, how do you see like the risk assessment of your loan originators? The companies you work very closely with, have you made any crucial mistakes in the past? If so, which?
I think when it comes to risk scores and ratings, and it's still too early to say like if it's a mistake or not. Obviously, it's easy to say that hey, the loan originator was rated I don't know B, and then it experienced the problem, and then that is a kind of a mistake. But that's not statistical. There's not enough statistics to actually be confident about that conclusion ourselves as well. So we definitely look at the what we could have improved and did we miss something or not. But then having higher rating doesn't mean that it's not going to have any problems or there's not going to be any defaults whatsoever. There's going to be. It's just from the rating perspective, those problems should be to less extent or much less. Frequently than somebody, some loans which are rated worse, so with a lower rating. So that's when it comes to rating. On specific cases, I think that with the information which we had at the time, in hindsight, it's super easy to say, I don't know, we shouldn't have connected any company in Kosovo because it's, it ended up with two companies losing the license for the reason which still nobody understands, like what was the reason real behind that. With hindsight, it's super easy. When we were connecting them, so we were pretty sure that it's like for the return which investors are getting, the risks are reasonable, and we saw that we can connect them to the Mintos and they can offer those loans to investors. So it's I wouldn't go into kind of analysis based on hindsight. So we have to look back at the time when we had to make decisions and based on the information which we had at that time.
Mm. Okay. Let's go into the specifics with one particular loan originator and their group companies. I want to talk about the Finco Group and Vaax. Less than a year ago, it was March this year, the Finco Group has been the biggest loan originator on Mintos. They had an outstanding loan portfolio of around 100 million euro. And now the company reminds a bit more of an empty nutshell. What is your take on this in general? And can you just briefly explain how you think that happened?
I think the take is obviously that I'm not sure if the amazing is the best word to use, but just how quickly it could go from like one of the leading lending companies, not on Mintos, but in general in the market and in those markets, to what is now, it's not even empty shell, it's basically on the way of winding down and like kind of ceasing operations. It's just like took basically what, like 6, maybe 9 months for that to happen. And then really, that then actually it all started with Armenia case, and then also the same Armenia case. So like still nobody knows like for what reasons what happened there. But then that basically ended up with all the company going into the wind down. So it is amazing to see, because we also saw how it's was developing and how it was built, and it was really, as you say, one of the largest, with like more than 1,000 employees, market leading positions in the countries where they were operating, and then basically just is now what you could definitely say out of business or winding down.
I want to stretch a bit the topic of the Finco Group offered buyback guarantee. I just would quickly quote something from the Mintos blog. JSC Finco Group, the ultimate parent company of the Finco Group companies, is fully obligated to fulfill any payments to Mintos investors related to loans issued by any of the Finco Group companies. The agreement between Finco Group and Mintos was signed at the beginning of March 2020. Question to me is, how come this group guarantee has never been exercised by Mintos until this day, although many Finco Group companies have struggled or still struggle to pay back the loans?
Well, the buyback is what we also have now renamed is to buyback obligation. It's really about the company really covering those. If it's a group, then they cover the, if there are some problem cases, then they would step in and cover. But of course, that will be only if they have means to do that. If you look at the Finco, so basically Armenia, which was a cash cow and generating all the profits, they were supporting other group companies. And the other group companies now, which when they saw that the non-performing loans increased, they have to do the buybacks, they don't have the means. But the Armenia is also in the wind down, so they are not generating any profit. So basically, what you end up, yes, there is a buyback obligation, but the provider of the buyback, they don't have any means. It's not the case that there is a magical group of works which is sitting on a cash pile and not not works, but of Finco on the group level, and that is not executed. There's just no assets into this. Group and the group consists, of course, of the daughter companies in specific countries. And basically, since Armenia went into the wind down, there's no really kind of assets which we could use to access to basically exercise a buyback obligation.
But do you think in this regard it's fair or it's justified to promote a buyback guarantee to promote safe investments, which in fact they're not, and you know, kind of a bit also misleading investors with securities that, you know, with eventualities they apparently can't be, you know, used and are not applied?
I think it's again comes down to education. So the buyback guarantee, and that's also one of the reasons why we went away from the guarantee, because there's some misconceptions. A guarantee means that it's 100% gonna happen no matter what. So the guarantee is only, well, as good as the one which provides a guarantee. So there's no there's no kind of United States staying behind the guarantee, and then it's going to happen.
But even if you call it buyback, sorry, but even if you call it buyback obligation, you know, what's the point of promoting kind of safe investments or promoting investments in that sense, no matter how you call it, if it's buyback guarantee, if it's buyback obligation? Don't you think this is kind of misleading investors to the ability, you know, or into the securities of the loans they're investing into?
Well, the buyback obligation is a credit enhancement, so it is additional security layer on that, and it provides additional security. So if there is some problems with some of the loans and it happens not on the kind of across the whole group, then that actually does work pretty well. What we saw is the same UTSO in Kosovo, where they had the problem, so the buyback actually provided additional security. So in that sense, I would say that buyback obligation is still additional security layer. The thing though is what I totally kind of see your point is that it is not kind of 100%. There's no notion of kind of guaranteed is something which we have to work on. And that is one of the reasons why I actually went away from the guarantee to the obligation, because even though guarantee is a legal term, it just basically says that somebody going to guarantee. It's the same as a mortgage business. I don't know, if you go to the bank, bank asks for the somebody of your spouse or somebody to guarantee your payments, but that doesn't mean that the bank is guaranteed to get back on the loans if something happens. So but still we changed to the obligation, and that's it is continuous education of investors that it doesn't mean that it is the same as, I don't know, deposit guarantee.
Do you think from an outside perspective, or you from an inside perspective, can you understand when investors maybe struggle to see that there's, let's say, a shareholder overlap on Finco's side, on Mintos' side, and maybe that plays a part in why Mintos is not really acting accordingly to what they have promised in the first place, but rather kind of a bit hiding behind, sorry, there's no capability at this time being, we would sabotage, you know, forcing that group guarantee right now, and it would, you know, sabotage the leftovers, what is required to pay back the other loans. What can you say? Do you think this, do you understand from an outside perspective that the shareholder overlap doesn't really look good on this particular situation?
I think from the outside, you can draw a lot of theories, and like there's obviously, we live in the world where there's a lot of conspiracy theories. So to be honest, when we look at the overlap, it always has been out there. So it has been depicted. If some people believe that it is a problem, then they had this information and could have chosen not to invest in those loans. If you ask me from the inside perspective, actually having the overlap is beneficial. So we have much, much better working relationship with those lending companies. And when it comes to the kind of executing on the buyback or basically forcing the buyback obligation, if we could and there would be assets, there's no difference for us if it's affiliated lending company or not affiliated. So it goes the same process. Which is again governed by the agreements and our legal setup with the lending company. So we don't take those decisions lightly. So there's like a proper credit committees and independent people involved and so forth. So it's actually follows exactly the same process. So I would say that having a overlap is actually beneficial, because then we can have a better working relationship with the lending company. But well, I understand people who believe that overlap is something not good, which is fair. Everyone can have their own preferences, and that's why we offer different lending companies. If you look on the loans from different lending companies, so on Mintos now, if you look, there are 58 different lending companies. Four of them are affiliated, and if people don't want to use those, they can invest in loans originated by 54 other lending companies. And that is obviously a question. And well, if you look at some other platforms which are in a way mono lenders, then there is 100% overlap between platform and the companies which originate the loan, because the platform is originating the loans, right? So every investor definitely can make their own kind of assessment, and that is the value which we can bring, is that there's a lot of different loans to invest in on Mintos, and different countries, different lending companies, borrowers, and so forth.
So basically, you don't see a conflict of interest with this shareholder overlap, but instead you find it beneficial because there's like closer collaboration structures in place.
No, technically, it's obviously, technically, well, any overlap will be conflict of interest. It's a question how you manage that conflict of interest. So on our side, all the lending companies, we always have looked at them the same. It doesn't matter if there is some overlap of shareholders or not. And then when it comes to the actually the recovery cases, what we see, the much better relationship is or working relationship is with those affiliated.
But probably you would draw an exception with Finkl and Vax.
That it's better, or
that this, in, or this case, that this case in this case it helped Mintos or investors to recover funds.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, if it was not, then I think from Vark's perspective, they would just say, hey, here you go, here's your gross portfolio of, I don't know, this and that amount, and good luck with recovering and collecting those payments, especially now when the war came into the play as well. That would easily, so I think many of the lending companies would just say, well, it doesn't matter for us, just you can take over the portfolio and good luck recovering what you can. So in that respect, for sure, I think that investors are much better served that it was or it is there was some overlap of shareholders.
Mm. Right now with Finkl, there's like assets worth 30 million roundabout in the recovery process, 17 million alone in Armenia, so with connected with Vax. So what do you think are the chances that those funds can be recovered according also to that 2-year plan that you have in place now? To repay everything by the end of 2022.
On exact numbers, it's the best is to refer to our website. So we provide the updates there. So we have a separate section on recoveries. If you look conceptually, then it's still too early to say. Like we can provide some estimates, but also previously we provided estimates, but nobody knew that there's going to be war between Armenia and Azerbaijan. So that also didn't help us. Or the works to make collections. So let's see how it goes. So our intent with every recovery case is to recover 100%. Obviously, we also are cognizant that it's not going to be 100% in each and every case. So also with works, we do our best to recover as much as possible. Will we get there? Let's see. It's still, as with any recoveries, it's a long play. So there's still a lot, especially for works, a lot of loans are still outstanding. They have to be collected. With all the pandemic, war, and so forth, it doesn't come that easy. So, but even with all that, investors have already seen that, I guess, already more than 10 million euros have been recovered.
Hmm. Okay. Why have investors not been involved somehow into that, you know, submitting a feedback to that proposal on that restructuring plan until the end of 2022, like it happened, for instance, with Capital Service? So where do you draw the line between we're involving investors and asking them about their feedback, or we, you know, just make the decision on our own what we believe is best for the investor?
In Capital Service was more as an exception that we kind of involve investors in negotiation. It was more that basically Capital Service just came with such a ridiculous offer. They said, yeah, but the investors might want to like this offer, which we said, well, be assured they're not going to like. And then we just made a survey, and what I think like 95% people said that, well, sure, we're not going to accept it. It's kind of a ridiculous offer, right? So in general, at our scale and having that many investors, it's very hard for us to have any proper way of involving investors. So say in the same, I think in Finkl or in Vark's, it's maybe like 60, 70 or 80,000 investors who have invested. Like there's no good way how we can actually involve all of them, and all of them have proper say how it is should be done. And if you involve, it's just like super lengthy process and doesn't doesn't bring any benefit to the negotiation. So negotiation is basically, in general, we would see that investors, well, at the end of the day, investors have to trust that we do our best to recover the funds from those cases where there are recoveries.
Mm. Another question related to Finco and outstanding loans. Why have only 10% of the purchasing price of that Sebo and Mogo deal have been used to cover those outstanding debts?
10% were...
Wasn't it 10%? Like the deal was
it was a small percentage. Yeah. If you say about the percentage what went to the to actually investors, it was a small, because the deal involved restructuring and they had to pay up the equity as well, so that basically they had to bring it back to statutory levels, and then that meant that the deal price was higher, but the net proceeds which we had for investors was smaller than that.
Okay, but you think like, so there was nothing more to give for investors other than 10% then in that case?
No, it was maximum. I mean, we were happy that, well, we got actually the deal done in that case, because basically what we could have ended up is with a 15 million portfolio, which is going into the wind down, and then investors would see some capital loss. Now, at least we saw zero capital loss. Well, it's still, of course, under Mogo, but Mogo is providing the buyback obligation, but we got also some proceeds, which obviously in the best case we would get the most the more you get the better, but in that case it's was actually very good, well, in our opinion, good deal for investors that they could actually, those who had invested in Sebo got it covered by the Mogo, and then the rest got at least some proceeds from the deal.
Mm. On the Mintos blog, also looking back to March, it was stated that the Finco Group had a net profit of 17.6 million euro in 2019. Just a couple months later, then in June, I would like to quote this, not to read anything or quote anything not properly. After a thorough review of Finco Group's financial standing, the group guarantee is not being exercised, as the group would not be able to cover VARC's outstanding portfolio on Mintos in a single payment. Possible legal actions to enforce Finco Group's guarantee at this moment would jeopardize the overall expected recovery amount, both for VARC's and other group's companies. So going from that incredibly high net profit that was also then promoted on Mintos in March, then 3 months later, it was said we couldn't cover the outstanding portfolio in a single payment, but maybe it could have been a partial payment, or I don't know to which extent that actually happened. Can you comment on this, please? And, you know, because I think many investors are confused, where has all that money gone? Why is such a profitable and huge organization that collaborates with Mintos? What can happen in a turn of 3 months from totally high selling, you know, kind of safe investments with group guarantees, offering or claiming that there's a huge earnings, a highly profitable business operation, and then 3 months later there's obviously not enough to cover some outstanding debts then to investors. So what can you comment on this?
The profit obviously doesn't mean that it's kind of cash on the balance sheet sitting, so all the profits would have to obviously check like in details, but in general, as any company which is in the growth stage, all the profit is reinvested in the business. So even though they were profitable, so Finco was very much growing significantly in 2019 as well. So opening up new countries, so basically you have CapEx. So Armenia was in a way supporting those expansion plans. So the profit doesn't mean that there is cash on the balance sheet. So it's at that stage, so basically they are investing it, reinvesting in the business and growing the business. And in the same Armenia, so a lot of the profit was reinvested in growing the business in Armenia.
Hmm. Let's talk about VARC, because I did something which I rarely do. It would be the wrong phrasing, but I looked at the VARC financial report of 2018. And probably it's a bit of a longer introduction now before I come to that question. But basically it was But I tried to sum it up before I mm-hmm. quote it. I can maybe embed it to the video somehow. But basically, Vaax was in breach with two figures that were required from Mintos side, which is one an equity to asset ratio, and the other was a cash buffer ratio. Overall, like there was a secured, or maybe I have to read it, secured loans from other entities amounting to 8.2 million Armenian dollars with a contractual maturity less than 1 month. According to the terms of the agreement, the organization is subject to a debt covenant stating that starting from 31st of December 2018, at the end of each quarter, the equity to asset ratio cannot fall below 20% and cash buffer ratio should not fall below 5%. Now, and when I checked the figures for 2018, basically equity to asset ratio was 13.76%, cash buffer ratio was 1.33%. And then it continues, as of 31st of December 2018, the organization was in breach of these covenants. Management obtained a waiver on 23rd of April 2019, stating that the lender has waived the organization's failure to comply with the above mentioned covenants at 31st December 2018 and 31st of March 2019. Now, I'm pretty sure that the waiver on April 23rd this has been kind of a necessity by the auditor in order to sign off the report then, which happened a few days later. What I'm wondering is, up until the license has been revoked a year later then with Vaax in March 2020, I mean, Vaax was rated on Mintos with a B plus rating, and also 95% of their net lending portfolio in 2018 was funded through Mintos and Mintos investors. Now, to me, the question is, assuming Mintos was fully aware of Vaax dependency on one side, but also on the financial breaches, why have there been no consequences applied before the license was then revoked a year later? But instead, Vaax loans, you know, they have been pushed on Mintos with forward flow, with a new product. They have been pushed with cashback campaigns. Overall, it's honestly a very big mystery for me how Mintos has looked at this situation, maybe has overlooked the situation at Vaax, understanding their high dependency and also their financial situation, which, yeah, just showed to be not to the extent Mintos would have liked to seen it. Sorry for the long question, though.
Yeah, it is a long question. I guess how we look at that is like the covenants themselves is obviously there so that we can have a proper kind of figures to look at, and they have to follow them. But it's not only works. In other cases, also we see that the covenants are breached, and that's something which happened and will happen. Then the question is, what do you do once they are breached, and how quickly they can be brought back to the required level, which is actually the same what you would see in the bank. So when the bank gives you all the credit, they have a covenant. If you breach, it doesn't mean that you are defaulted immediately. So there is an action plan how it has to be brought back. And the same we do with the lending companies here. So we set out the covenants so that we can basically monitor them better. And then if some of them are breached, then we put together an action plan, and that is work towards to bring it back. When it comes to works, I think to the extent when you say that it was pushed, so the rating is it wasn't like the best rating. Obviously, if it were not perhaps for those things you mentioned, it could have been better. But on a loan portfolio basis, they were one of the best loan originators in Armenia, so one of the leading players, originating quite a lot of loans and having a good payoffs, and that's basically why we allowed them to place them on Mintos. If that answered the question, because it was a bit long question, so
yeah.
Kind of so, specific follow-ups, comment.
No, I see. But to me, it's less about the waiver in general. I think obviously you see there's a debt or there's a covenant in place, and you try to put certain rules in place. And obviously when there is a breach, you know, I guess it was a necessity from the auditor. I think it was KPMG to say, look, unless this is figured and you get a waiver, we're not signing off this report. I can imagine it could have went down like this. that's not the point to me. The point to me is Mintos understanding the financial structure, or the how to say this, the financial overall situation of VARX, that maybe risk haven't been put into place or assessed accordingly for investors. And it's okay, it's a rating, it's a very unfortunate rating, I guess, but it's also the point of, I think it was very unfortunate then pushing with a new product forward flow, especially with VARX loans, which I think you were probably quite upset back then, and also when the license was revoked, but you also offered initial cashback campaigns. Why do you do this with a loan originator understanding they depend very much on investor funds from Mintos, and secondly, that have obviously some financial issues, regardless of their positioning or their standing in Armenia, that, you know, makes it very hard then, in case a license gets revoked or something else happens, some circumstances, that this is kind of screwing up the entire situation, and also kind of was a very big blow off, I think, to also start to blow up the entire Finco organization then as a consequence, with many aspects then taken into consideration. The question is why Mintos hasn't been more careful on this, and why you just push to promote those investments, although you should have seen very closely what's going on and what's wrong on VARX side.
I think I would disagree that the license was not revoked because of the financial reason. Sure. So the license was revoked for, well, still we don't know, like, for exact reasons. So some say it's political, some say like their market participants. Well, nobody knows like what happened, but this is the license itself was not because the VARX was like financially weak or something, or the vote. So on that front, I would say that actually when we look at their loans at that time. So given the kind of our assessment, it seemed like a proper return for the risk investors are taking. So in that sense, I would say that it wasn't like anything specific to VARX or pushing or something. It's a good loans originated by one of the leading players in Armenia, and they were positioned on marketplace as such. The license itself, I would say, it was much more kind of a random event which happened, not really something which we could see from the financial, because it wasn't really financials related. So that's perhaps how I would see the situation there.
And would you say Mintos, again, like the discussion we had before, like understanding or having the information at hand that you had back then a year ago, you made the best decision, and you know, you would basically do it all over again, moving forward the way you did.
Well, with hindsight, it's super easy to say, of course, that I don't know, we should have had, like, you know, that they can, but that also wouldn't change the situation much if there would be kind of limits how much they fund through the Mintos. So if it were just 20% what they would fund through Mintos, the situation would be the same. So 20% of the portfolio, once they go into the wind down because the license is revoked, so it's still under risk and would fall into the recovery. So the situation would be the same. So maybe the amount would be different. It could be that well, the rating is something which perhaps could have been scrutinized even more, but it's basically, I would have to involve the risk team much more in this discussion, how they go about that, and kind of go into more details about this. Overall, I think definitely you can, with hindsight, you can improve a lot of things. With information which we had, I think we try to do our best in that situation. We just also understand that, well, I just also remembered that, well, at that time in 2018 or 19, when investors were themselves doing assessment of loans of VARX, they said that it's actually one of the best loans available on the marketplace. So it's not only us who are putting them on the marketplace and making assessment, it's also investors. So there wasn't anything like specific which would make us think differently.
You mentioned twice now that you still don't know exactly why the license of VARX has been revoked in Armenia. Can you explain what your assumption is, why it has been revoked? And secondly, I don't know the Armenian central bank to that extent, that well to that extent, but maybe I can assume that even if there was some issues with Vax, I don't know if that's political related or whatever it is, maybe you can explain what your take is, but wasn't there maybe not anything like a notice or any like some sort of warning, something that, you know, obviously Vax didn't comply with some sort of rules that could have been adjusted? Because it's hard for me to imagine that, you know, this decision just happens from one day to the other without any warning. Also understanding this is like one of the, as you said, top non-bank lending companies in Armenia, trying to or to service a lot of loans, a huge amount of loans. How can that happen overnight without a warning? And what's your take why the license has ultimately been revoked then?
Obviously, we do know the technical reason. So there was just technicality, which the central bank used. So the real reason, even talking with Finkel and Varx, still people would just speculate. So there's no good understanding. And the reason is the same what you say. If it is kind of unpredictable or unprecedented, it's like in one day, they just say, no, that's it. You're going to lose a license, even though the technical reason which was brought up, the Varx was ready to remedy it and to change it and to pay in the capital, which, or the basically to repay the subordinated debt or the debt which they had to repay, but basically was said, no, it's that's it, you have to basically be gonna revoke the license. So that basically perhaps speaks of the unpredictability, and I would say eventually it is perhaps what we have to put it down to is basically the country risk, and that's basically would fall under the country or kind of political, maybe, or I don't know how to call it, but the risk which you cannot really explain in any other way.
Okay, so my take on this is there was a technical reason. Vax was about to fix it, but then eventually the central bank decided to revoke the license.
It wasn't that. It was, I think, basically Vax said, yeah, well, we can fix it in what, like in a week or in a month, and then the next day central bank without any consultation comes out and says no, the license is revoked, even though they have had the same setup for like last 3 years. I had always discussed with the bank, everyone was fine with that, and then all of a sudden they just changed their opinion. So it's I mean, I was not in the room. It's hard for me to speculate. From what I know, there's still nobody really understands what happened and why it happened.
Okay. Last topic.
Obviously, just to finish, if the Varx would have known, they would have done all the things possible to kind of change that. Because of course, well, at the end of the day, who is losing the most, of course, is well, investors at least are getting now the recovering some funds, but well, equity investors and Varxes are the last in line to get anything, so they're going to lose the most of this. So if Varx would have known, of course, they would have done all things possible to change it.
Let's discuss the very last topic. Just a couple more questions until I can release you. It's the schedule extension feature. It's something that Mintos implemented back in October 2019. Can you just quickly explain what that exactly is and why you have implemented this?
So schedule extension is basically what is happening in lending, especially when it happens in short-term lending. So the borrower takes a loan for, I don't know, a month or maybe 3 months. Then comes the day when they have to make the payment. They go to the lending company and they basically ask for extension because they cannot pay at that time. So they basically extend the loan for a few more months or additional months, or basically agree on a new schedule. So before the October 2019, or how we dealt with extensions, so even though they were happening and they are super common in the lending, especially in alternative lending, basically what we had in the process in place was if the loan is extended, then the lending company has to buy back the loan from investor, and the new loan and place the extended loan as a new loan on the marketplace, which works perfectly fine. If there's like demand all the time for those loans, so nobody notices, investors get back the money from the lending company, comes new loan, they invest in the same loan and basically nothing happens. Even though the lending company, they have not received the cash from the borrower. So they have to come up with the cash themselves to buy it back and then place it on the marketplace. So many lending companies said that that doesn't work. Unfortunately, it was later than earlier. So we should perhaps, looking back, should have forced them to implement it sooner, so that basically the setup would be that when the borrower comes to the lending company and they ask for the extension, and the lending company might offer the extension themselves if they see that that is the best interest of actually recovering the loan. So then that is also showed to the investors, basically that the loan has been extended because the borrower has not repaid. And that is something which we implemented in 2019, October. And then with the moratoriums and everything coming to the play in March, and with all the loans being extended even more so than usual, then that become even more crucial for the lending companies, because otherwise they got squeezed in between when they have to buy back the loan, but they don't have cash because the borrowers have not repaid. So that's what we had to, on a short notice, actually implement for all the lending companies in March 2020.
To me, thanks for explaining first. And secondly, I think it's also an integration that made perfectly sense. And I think from investor side, it's very hard to argue against this. Now we move forward a couple of months. Now we have March 13th. You announced loan originators are able to prolong those extensions from 3 to 6 periods, which means, let's say, there's always investors that look for very, you know, high liquidity. If they invest into some payday loans, maybe they have to wait up until 6 months now to get their money back in the best case. Can you first explain with the moratorium why this extension then to 6 periods?
It's basically, in many countries, it was the governments going out and saying, hey, borrowers can hold on repaying the loans for extended period of time, like months, 2 months, 3 months or whatnot. And then on top of that, if you have like usual extensions, which in general for payday loans, I think at the average is something like 3-point-something times or 3-point-something months, which is extended maybe more. So up to, I think, 5 or 6. So that's when we said, okay, there has to be some limit how much it can be extended. If it goes up above that, then the lending company has to actually buy it back and deal with that. If we would not have done it, so if it would not be for extensions, perfectly we understand what investors, like, they invest in a 1 month loan and then it becomes kind of 1 month plus something. But what is an alternative? Alternative is that the lending company has to buy them back, but they don't have a means because they don't have cash. The cash is still outstanding with the borrower. So you basically just would force the lending companies in, you can force them in bankruptcy in that way, actually.
Also, in that case, I think it's still okay, or I think it's still bearable. To me, what my personal problem with that topic is, and comes a couple days later, what you announced March 23rd, when you set up also the loan extension also for outstanding and for defaulted loans. And what it means to me, in essence, is that, you know, for loans where, you know, there was contractual agreements already in place, and you just said, like, ultimate liquidity has to be offered for lending companies to, you know, keep their survival, and where use investors' liquidity for that. And I don't know, those sudden changes that you made back then with user agreements, with terms and conditions, do you think this is something applicable in a regulated environment? Do you think, as being a licensed company, those kind of steps that you have applied would have been possible?
I'm not sure if the regulation covered that in that respect. So how we were looking at the situation was, well, what is an alternative? Sure, we can say the lending companies, even though, for instance, I don't know, in the extreme case, so for instance, you have a lending company which has a portfolio of 10 million euros, all of the, or most of the portfolio is extended because the borrowers or moratoriums or lending company just agrees with the borrowers that it has to be extended. But then you have the investors who are saying, hey, I invested for 1 month, it is due, I need 10 million back. But what can you, what's the alternative there? So you can say, yes, well, the lending company has to buy them back, but they don't have the means. So there's not really, well, what can you do there? So there's not really much what you can do when you have the loans extended on the borrower side. So you have, that is something which we had to implement on the very short notice, and it wasn't kind of a light decision on our behalf. But the alternative would be that we would see like much more in recoveries than we see now.
Okay, thank you very much for your answers today, Martins. Been a long interview, probably around
one hour
30 minutes. Thanks for standing by. And thanks again for taking some time answering the questions. Wish you well now for the upcoming Christmas days. Hope you're coming well into the new year. And then I guess we talk for sure then 2021 again.
Likewise, Denny. It's my pleasure. Thanks for the questions. Very interesting and detailed questions. And hopefully we next time we manage to meet face to face and have the interview in the old format instead of those video calls all the time.
The old-fashioned style. All right, Martins. Thanks again.
All right, Denny.
Bye-bye.
Take care.